Welcome back for episode 5 of Unpaved, the last in our first series. We're starting off in Froome at the Bicycle Academy, and we're going to be chatting to Tom Sturdy from Sturdy Cycles and Jack Watney, who's also a teacher here. Then we're going to be talking to one of the alumni from the Bicycle Academy later, Adeline O'Moreau, who is the founder of Mercury Cycles.
Hello! Hey, how are you?
Good morning, how are you?
Come in.
I would give you a hug, but I'm a bit soggy.
Oh, this is Albert's soggy as well.
Hello, Albert.
So we went up to the office upstairs and there was bikes adorning everything.
Hanging in the rafters here is the Tom Ritchie frame. So Tom Ritchie travelled over from the US and did a brazing demo here and then took out riding with us. These are bikes made for the Hack Bike Derby. Builders were invited to a race, but also a kind of build-off, and they had to make a clunker-style mountain bike. Andrew's is drum brake, honky horn on the front.
I mean, that one didn't have appropriate crank clearance, so we had to do that with the back end of an axe.
These are the two bikes we built for Grinduro last year. So
very different.
Yeah, yeah. Hardtail mountain bike with lefty fork. Tom Sturdy rode it. We designed the entire thing around this really amazing fork, and Tom rode the entire race with it locked out. He was like, don't need it. And then the other bike we built is a gravel bike.
And it's got splat grav written on the top tube.
Yeah, the gravel bike we painted in the car park with, about 5 cans of spray bike. And Andrew held it while Tom sprayed it and tried not to get paint on each other.
At this point, I thought it'd be a good idea to get on with our chat with Tom and Jack.
So I'm Tom, head of education at the Bicycle Academy. So doing day-to-day delivery of courses, organising future courses, custom courses, that type of stuff. Inevitably get involved with a bit of everything else as well.
My name's Jack. I do a mix of roles. I teach, work in communications, and I work in the retail side of things as well.
Can you explain exactly what the Bicycle Academy is and the sort of philosophy behind it?
The Bicycle Academy is great in my eyes because it's not just about coming along and having a go. And actually in mainstream education, I found that was a lot of the ways that normal teachers taught as well. They'd come up with a lesson plan that would be, right, today we're going to be doing this and you're going to do it like this. And that's what you would do. There's a lot of reasons why that happens, but really the best way to learn something is by being having things properly explained to you so that you can make your own decisions about how you might use the techniques that are involved. And the bicycle, the idea is that education is at our forefront of what we do. It's not just about coming along and making a frame. It's about properly appreciating and understanding the everything involved when you are beginning to learn the fundamentals of frame building. There's limitations because it all takes place within a time period, a period of time. But it's about coming and having a learning experience as much as it is about just making a nice, pretty thing. Different types of students have different expectations. So some people come with, wildly different. We might have someone who just wants to make a lovely shiny thing, and that's cool, that's great, we can do that. But you might also have very experienced frame builders coming to improve their skills. We do a bunch of skills masterclasses for people that are looking to perhaps progress in new techniques or want a bit more guidance in something they're already doing. So to me, what I saw was from the outside, I saw properly supportive environment in which you could make mistakes, ask questions, and learn properly what it is that you're doing, not just be shown how to do a thing.
Are there any names that people might have heard of that have come from the Bicycle Academy?
Yeah, certainly if you're into the handmade bike scene, then there's a bunch. What about more mainstream ones, Tom? Can you think of any off the top of your head?
Certainly, like Jack said, in the kind of hand-built bike sphere, if you like, there's a, I think we did it one year. Most of the shows, there's a pretty high percentage of exhibitors who have been in some way involved in the Bicycle Academy, whether it's on a frame boarding course or masterclasses. We also do sort of consultancy work and training work with bigger manufacturers as well. So people who aren't, you know, custom frame builders, we might be involved in training production staff or design staff and that sort of thing. So there's quite a few projects like that where, yeah, there are lots of bikes out there that we've had something to do with, for sure.
But they've got NDAs.
Lots going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. But you can, if you look into the handmade scene, certainly in the UK, but, you know, in Europe as well, obvious people spring to mind, like Quirk, like a really well-known person's Prova. Who else? Ted James used to be involved with us. He was not a student, but a teacher, and another excellent frame builder, Robin Mather as well.
Jake used to teach as well. Did Jake teach you, or was it Robin?
No, it was Robin. Right. Yeah, yeah. Jake Rusby. Yeah. Oh, and of course, Dear Susan Bicycles.
Of course, Peter.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't miss him.
Yeah. To be fair, we often get people who have started tinkering before coming to us.
Yeah.
So Peter had been making bikes kind of as art projects, and then he came to us and he made it was sort of a bike, wasn't it?
I think so. He made I wasn't actually here at the time when Peter came, but he built a tall bike, like
a tall fat bike.
I think it was he called it his tall Dax bike. It's the first tall bike he made
tall
here.
Dax.
Yeah.
First time I met Peter was at a cyclocross race called Thundercross in London, and there was like a fun race, and he was riding a tall fat bike, and they're in like Hawaiian shirt and like a sombrero or something. And I was like, who is this guy? And then he puts his bike into the back of a hearse, which he's driving. He's absolutely amazing.
Like Jack said, we get a real mix of different students and people come through. It's quite interesting to see the kind of different approach that people take. So Peter's a great example of someone who builds bikes, you know, very much from an artistic point of view, and he doesn't dress it up in any other way. That his bikes are kind of works of art rather than some other people who would come at it from a much more kind of engineering focused thing, and much more, you know, completely different approach and completely different product. And we see a really wide range of different people coming through with different expectations, different aspirations as well, which keeps us on our toes.
Do you see any trends in terms of when people come in, what kind of bikes they want to make, or what kind of purpose they're using them from?
It comes and goes, actually. We see kind of trends, and we might have like a month or 6 weeks of students wanting to build, you know, a very, very similar type of bike. And then for the next kind of 2 months, it's a completely different type, but again, along a theme. And we haven't yet worked out why that happens.
Some article on the Radimist or something, and everyone's like, I need something like this.
But one thing that I think certainly in one thing that I have noticed is that whereas a few years ago, or even, you know, 18 months ago, we were getting a lot of people coming here wanting to build relatively extreme or contemporary types of bikes. So like you'd get, you know, bikes with huge tire clearance, you know, big fat bikes, for example, or wanting to build bikes with the most kind of curved shaped profile tubing that you could, for example. That trend has definitely lessened.
Okay.
And people seem to be wanting... It's not that they don't want big tire clearance, but they're not going to the extremes that they perhaps were. And people definitely have settled on, and it's maybe because I'm persuading them, but people have settled away from kind of really contemporary tubing shapes and going back to round tubing shapes as well. That's definitely a trend.
Yeah, there was a period, certainly I remember when I started getting interested in frame building, when I was interested as well in the tubes that looked a bit like carbon. So Columbus and I think a few other companies as well make shaped tubing that you could argue that it probably exists because they were trying to create a product that would rival the aesthetics of a carbon bike. So people got used to very, you know, large down tubes, big bottom bracket junctions, things like that. And I thought, oh yeah, they look really cool when I first got into the idea of making bikes. But it's less and less frequent. I haven't heard anyone ask for a shaped down tube in ages.
I've just got good at making the face that stops them asking. No.
But sharp intake of breath.
I mean, I think partly what it could be is that even probably in the last, I would say, oh, I don't know, 3 years, people have got used to seeing round tube bikes again. So there was a while when Instagram was just flooded with, you know, the latest, high spec carbon frames. You know, any influencers you saw would be riding those things. Whereas over the past few years, particularly with the rise of gravel riding, I think, round tube bikes are more common. So there's loads of companies now that are really heavily marketing, and the visibility of those sorts of bikes, I think, is just
That's
greater.
Interesting. I guess you get companies like Kona and Genesis and those kinds of, where they're focusing more on all road or gravel or adventure bikes, mm-hmm. where we didn't typically have them so much or so prominently in the industry a few years ago. So people are, like you say, becoming conditioned to seeing those sort of steel bike packing off-road frames, and then actually finding them a bit more appealing.
Yeah, and some of the companies are just looking a bit cooler as well. Like, there was certainly a little while where, like, if you think of people, so people that have been around for longer and continue doing that sort of stuff, like Surly, there was probably a period, you know, not so long ago where that wasn't considered cool. And it definitely is now. Yeah. And there's also lots of brands trading on that, you know, brands that are newer, bike companies that are kind of using that image as well. So I don't know, things like Breadwinner or Bear Claw bicycles, like they are the things that come up on your Instagram Discover feed, and yeah, more people are seeing them, and I guess getting excited about it.
I think there's also a so you mentioned like the rise of kind of gravel riding and that type, you know, the nature of what people are after is, it's kind of an unfussy bike. You know, the whole point is it's a bit of everything,
yeah.
Or in a lot of cases, and people are increasingly converging on what they actually need that bike to be. So initially there was a big rush for, yeah, I just need the biggest possible tires and this, that, and the other. And actually there's been a realization by the people using the bike, but also the people making the bike, says, hold on, actually we don't need that, and we don't need this, maybe something more kind of or less extreme, if you like, in both in terms of the design of the bike in terms of clearance and geometry, and but also the tubing and all that sort of stuff. I think that's converged on what people actually want, which is perhaps not as extreme as everyone thought it was.
Yeah, I guess if you're making the investment to come and make a frame, then the sort of one bike to do it all philosophy concept might be quite interesting, something that you could have several wheel sets for, where it could be a road or a gravel bike. But I guess that raises a question. It's, I don't know, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it from a physiological perspective, perhaps, mm-hmm. on whether then that's really compromising whether you're in the best position for both of those, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer, in that it is definitely increasingly popular, that concept of one bike to do everything. From a certain point of view, that just isn't really possible. It sort of depends on what you mean by everything. You know, designing and making anything, you're going to have to make a series of, call them optimizations, call them compromises, but it's very difficult to genuinely have one thing that's going to be good at everything. Inevitably, the more you try to do that, the less good it is at any one specific thing. And so that there's potentially a bit of a risk from that point of view. And that's something that we always try and talk openly about with students who are hoping to do that. You know, I always try and, you know, someone wants a bike that they can put their kind of 700c 25 mil tires on and ride in the group ride, but then they also want to take it on some fairly extreme, you know, bike packing trips. you could do that, but it's probably not going to be great at both of those things. You're going to have to go one way or the other. But yeah, it's a very, very common request, is that people want, and it makes sense, they're coming here to build normally their first bike. They want a bike that they're going to be able to keep for as long as possible. And it definitely is doable to a certain extent.
I think something that Tom does quite well in the courses is help people understand the implications of the choices that they're making. So, yeah, like you say about group rides versus the massive off-road tour, it might be that you want to do that anyway, and so you just understand that during those group rides, maybe your bike doesn't feel quite as, like, racy, for want of a better word, as perhaps you might like from a bike that was just specifically for group riding on the road.
Yeah, I think once people properly understand what things have to change in order to accommodate everything that they want and what that actually means for riding it, then they can make the decision whether they want to do that or not. I think initially that there probably is a bit of confusion that, well, why can't I just make it take big tires, and then it's just got big tires and that'll be fine. So yeah, I think once people properly understand what it is that they're changing, then it's easier for them to decide whether they're okay with that or they actually want something a bit more specific.
So what is changing? What's wrong with that?
So typically there's a few key dimensions that will govern a rider's experience of using a bike. And those are things like the wheelbase of the bike, things like the height of the bottom bracket off the ground, and then some to do with the steering geometry. So not exclusively head angle, so talking more about the trail of the steering geometry, which is related to head angle, but not just about that. Those things are some of the key dimensions that will affect how the bike feels every time you use it. And if you want, for example, to make a bike able to accommodate relatively large tires and some mud, then all of those things have to change, and so you end up inevitably affecting how the bike is going to feel compared to a road bike or compared to any type of bike, really. It's you can't accommodate the gear that you want to put on it without affecting those dimensions.
So specifically on that point then, what are the limitations? If you say you're typically building road frames but then moving towards off-road, mm-hmm. what sort of things do you need to think about? You sort of mentioned the steering geometry and wheelbase. Could you just go into a bit more detail on those and how that's changed when you're going to off-road?
Sure. So, we've kind of seen this happen as gravel bikes have become... I'm not really sure. Do you call them gravel bikes still? Everyone's got a different name for them.
Yeah, you can call them whatever you like. I quite like, somebody said the other day, multimedia. I quite like that.
So as they've come about, there's definitely, some of the first ones that were certainly done mainstream. And in fact, I built a similar bike when I was experimenting with it myself, and I know Jack did as well, was effectively to take a road bike geometry and somehow squeeze big tires in it. And often that was by reducing the rim diameter, so rather than using 700c, you could keep all the dimensions of the road bike the same and just fit a 650 with a bigger tire on it, and that happened. So Cannondale Slate was a good example of that, the Specialized Diverge as well, and then there's a load of frame builders who made the same mistake. No, the mistake's putting it strongly, but it doesn't perhaps work. It certainly, for me, it didn't work as well as I wanted it to. And so typically what has to change in order to accommodate the larger tires, and that's nearly always the thing that forces it, you have to make the chain stays longer, which has an impact on making the wheelbase of the bike longer. Often you need a different bottom bracket height as well, because if you keep it as low as on a road bike, then you have problems with pedal strike, and you're just going to be riding it on more varied terrain, so you inevitably have to make the bike a little bit higher And then one of the other major things is that road bikes often will have a degree of toe overlap with the front wheel. So I'm sure...
As a small person, I understand.
if you're small or you've got big feet, or to be honest, there's a lot of, you know, most road bikes will have a degree of toe overlap where you can't turn the wheel past your forwards foot as you're pedaling, which it's not really a problem on a road bike because it's very rare. Well, certainly after you've done it once, it's very rare that happens when you're using the bike for its intended use. But as soon as you go at slower speed, as soon as you take it on more challenging variable terrain, that does become an issue. And again, the only real solution to that is to move the front wheel forwards. So again, you're kind of forced to change the wheelbase, but also and that generally is done by slackening the head angle. And by slackening the head angle, typically you will affect the trail of the steering geometry, which then affects how the bike feels when you're trying to turn or corner. So it's a little bit to do with the terrain, largely driven by the fact that you want bigger tires, just forces you to change all of those things away from what you would expect a pure road bike to have.
But there are things about those changes as well that make the bikes perhaps easier to handle on rough terrain as well. So like Tom mentioned about the bike that he built and then I built a sort of a version of, the second bike I built was in theory, winter road bike that could be a gravel bike if I wanted it to be. So had road geometry, very, very short wheelbase, very short chain stays, as short as possible. All the things that Tom mentions that you have to really change if you want to make a gravel bike. But I put 650B wheels on it and I just thought, toe overlap, whatever. And what I ended up with was a bike, which it looks incredible. I love it for a lot of reasons. But actually, my background is road riding. I'm used to the idea that, like, as long as your wheels are moving, or as long as you're moving in the same direction as your wheels are pointing, then everything's fine. And as soon as that changes, you're going to die. So so riding off-road at all on any loose surface throws me. What I didn't really think about was that actually building a bike for those surfaces, which has the same characteristics as a road bike, so really short, really, like some people describe it as like twitchy handling, but certainly very short wheelbase and a very short trail, might actually be quite frightening for someone who's not very good at riding bikes off-road. And for some people, I think it would be fine. Cyclocross riders, people like that. But those changes that are helpful to make in order to allow for bigger clearances, things like that, actually also might make the bike easier to handle, just like a mountain bike has a longer wheelbase or a slacker head angle. So for me, as someone from a road cycling background, it was a bit of a boo-boo, and I love it. It is fun, but I definitely need to get much better at riding it. I'm pretty sure... Did you see me fall off on the ride that we did?
Probably.
I don't ride it off-road an awful lot, but I've ridden it with Tom twice, and both times I've gone fully over the handlebars.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It happens to the best of us.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Yeah. but you look at where mountain bikes are going and you see, like, not necessarily downhill machines, but like enduro, and they're just getting longer and longer and longer. And like the distance between, I find it fascinating, the pedal and the front wheel is like huge. And obviously that's tackling those kind of steep trails. And I think when people think of the word gravel, they maybe think gravel roads, but actually, I don't know about you, but a lot of the gravel riding that I do is essentially mountain biking, like technical rooty stuff. Like, I'm not saying I'm doing it well, just like rocky things. And I guess having the confidence of a longer bike and a slacker head angle, that actually really helps. So not all gravel bikes are created equal in terms of the geometry. Like, there's such a range according to what you want to do with it.
Yeah, and I think that's why I generally try and not warn people away, but try and make people think about exactly what they want, because the term gravel bike, everyone's got such a different expectation of what that will be. Yeah. And if you are actually just riding it on gravel roads, then road bikes aren't that bad. You know, you can ride a road bike on gravel, it's not a problem. Understanding the degree to which it is a road of some sort or definitely not a road, that's really important because they need different things. I think there's definitely parallels between the sort of riding that you're doing and early mountain bikes. You know, a lot of gravel bikes are effectively very, very similar to some of the early mountain bikes. And in many ways, like, it's sort of helping people get into the tamer side of mountain biking.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
there's and we were talking about this before, I can remember a time, but it's still there a little bit, but I can remember a time where, you know, mountain bikers didn't talk to road bikers. And like, you know, it was, there were definitely distinct populations. And for a long time, mountain biking, just like the bikes that you're describing, it's sort of focused on the extreme stuff. And there's always been, it's always about how extreme the mountain biking can get. And I think there's a trend that is pulling back a little bit, but that's, I think, definitely helped by gravel bikes because it's a way that you can tackle what is essentially mountain biking, but it's not trying to do it in any extreme way necessarily. And perhaps it just makes the sort of mountain biking that people have access to more fun as well. So yeah, it's definitely blurring the lines a little bit more, which is nice.
But that thing about like people having access to, or what they have access to, that's like quite a big thing to consider as well. So you mentioned the sort of terrain that you ride on, and certainly around here it's similar sort of stuff. And you know, if you live in the southwest of England, that's broadly speaking probably the sort of trails you'll end up on, because there'll be bridleways or there'll be bits of little sort of single track through the woods. But for American riders, that might not be the case at all. In fact, you know, I was only watching a video the other day about the gravel trails that that you see in the Radivist, you know, the stuff that goes out of LA. It's completely different. They're wide trails, they're like entirely gravel. So actually understanding where people are coming from with their riding as well is a big part of what Tom does when he's talking about what people want to make, is like, where are you actually going to ride it, and how do you actually ride it. Some people might be coming from, we had some guys from Belgium the other day who were building that sort of bike, but they were planning to take it away into the kind of off-road areas of the Alps.
Wow.
So understanding what that terrain might be like as opposed to, what we might consider to be gravel. Mm-hmm. There's quite a big difference. And I was looking on Cycling News the other day, and it was showing I can't remember his name, Trek Segafredo rider, that
Peter Stettiner,
that's it, and they had an article about his his adapted road bike, it's meant to be for gravel, but you know, he's a racer, so what he considers like a good bike for things is quite a bit different.
Well, one of the biggest American races, I can't remember which one it was last year, the Rock Cobbler maybe, was one on a Trek Madon, an aero road bike.
Yeah.
It kind of shows you, doesn't it, right, how different it is. You couldn't exactly be popping one of those through the woods around here.
No, well, I mean, maybe they could.
But
that's, again, about where people are coming from, you know. I'm sure there's, like I said about my bike, there's plenty of people who could ride that and be totally comfortable and be like, oh, it's so capable. But for me, I just fall off. So I think context is really important, your fit sessions always have a big chunk of that, don't they? Working out where people are coming from and where they might be taking the bike.
So there's a lot of trends within this sort of off-road drop bar thing going on, like one by dropper posts. Are those something that you have to take into consideration in terms of the build when you're designing frames?
So whenever you're designing a frame, it's really important to understand the scope of the parts that are going to be put on it, definitely. That was more of a problem a few years ago, where the types of bikes that we're talking about were fairly new, and so component manufacturers hadn't really converged on standards. Standards are a thing that are notoriously difficult to get your head around in the bicycle industry. it's actually not really as bad as a lot of people think.
Is the word a bit misleading?
I think standard. So. Well, it's just that
it's what a whole range what of
tends
standards.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what tends to happen is that people come up with a kind of a new idea, and then they have a new problem to solve, and for a few years everyone comes up with their own solution to the same problem, which might be slightly different, and then you've got a load of these things that people call standards, where they're just someone's solution to a problem, and eventually everyone settles on what's clearly the best one. So yeah, in terms of bike design, anything that you're not going to be making, so the drivetrain, the seat post, you know, all of the wheels, the tires, all of those bits, you need to know what they are or what they might be to make sure that the frame's going to work with them. And so yeah, it's really important to kind of know what your options are. And that's why you'll see so stuff that's come effectively from mountain biking has become increasingly useful for the design of gravel or all-road or whatever you want to call them bikes, because that stuff is developed specifically to help you get big tires into the back of a bicycle. So
what sort of things would they be?
So things like boost spacing, so changes the rear axle spacing, so rather than a 142 hub, it uses a 148 millimeter hub, the over lock nut dimension technically, although there aren't any lock nuts anymore. But the most for frame design, the most important thing about that is it moves the chain line out. So you have an extra it's only a few millimeters but makes all the difference. So you have the chain ring sitting further outboard.
So does that also affect the bottom bracket?
No, and that's the good thing about Boost, is that whereas some of the other kind of wider standards, if you like, made everything wider. So the bottom bracket was wider. The Q factor of the pedals, so where you know the width of your feet effectively, was wider. Boost simply shifts the chainring and everything else kind of stays the same. So it just moves the interference point without affecting anything else really. So things like that, really good. Dropper post, pretty easy to accommodate in that they're available in the same sort of diameters that most other seat posts are. So that one's less of a consideration perhaps, although cable routing, that sort of stuff can be a consideration when you're thinking about a design. This is, and what I was saying about standards, this is a really good example of how it happens, because so for example, bikes that I was building for myself and for customers, so I've used a 1x drivetrain for years. I've had them on my own road bikes for years, way before, well, sort of, but way before you could actually buy 1x specific group sets. So I could build I had the idea and wanted to build that type of bike, but I, on my own in my workshop, don't have the buying power to enforce a group set that's going to work. So I kind of had to bodge things together until such a time that the main industry catches on, and then they're like, okay, right, here's a group set that everything's designed for it and it all works nicely, and you don't have to bodge a track chain ring and find a chain that so that's sort of how it happens, is that in order for standards to evolve and settle, you need big players to get on board with it, otherwise you're just banging your head against a wall, or not having enough money to bang it hard enough. So
what do you think is coming next? What do you think will be the next trend? Or
there's so many things, isn't there, but like a really obvious one you can see happening right now, I think anyway, is like flat bar gravel bikes, or just, you know, cross-country mountain bikes.
Hybrids.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Let's use a less sexy name for them, or they actually are.
Yeah, and I mean, you've been able to see that coming for a long time, but from all different sources, like things like track lacrosse bikes being like really trendy and popular on the internet, and then, you know,
difficult to ride.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Don't have the skills, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think like I've seen at some big gravel events, like people like Cannondale putting models of their kind of gravelly bike that they do out with the flat bars, like a little, one off.
I have to admit, I've been there. Like, I put flat bars on my old gravel bike since I've had the Mercury D, and put some 650B wheels on, and now I have a mountain bike.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah.
like
or is it a flat bar gravel bike? Who cares? It's just a bike. Like, yeah, it allows you to do something, right?
I think that's the important bit, is that it's just, there's nothing wrong with that kind of merging of different, what would have been previously separate disciplines of cycling.
Yeah.
And it's just this, yeah, that type of bike is probably the most relevant type of bike for the type of riding that most cyclists have easy access to, certainly in the UK.
Yeah.
And probably in other parts of the world as well, I imagine. Yeah, yeah. But I think the other thing that will come is suspension. That's definitely you're starting to happen already. It's an obvious step, and it's one that has commercial incentive behind it as well, because people will want to buy new frames then, and that puts money into the industry. So I think suspension or sort of increasingly sophisticated suspension on what is essentially a gravel or a light duty mountain bike. Or
there's a few different options already, isn't there, in terms of componentry, like the LAV fork or things within the seat post or stem. Do you see more of that coming within componentry or within the frame itself?
I think it will come within the frame itself. Rather than relying on the kind of passive suspension, some more active suspension, maybe some damped suspension, I think that will inevitably creep in, because the type of riding that people are doing on it increasingly warrants that type of thing. I mean, it's probably not long before it creeps into road bikes as well.
You could argue that it has with certain models of like Trek,
sort of
endurance road bikes. And
yeah, Trek,
it's all
yeah.
just a spectrum, really. We were talking about it on the train on the way here. So we've talked a little bit about people coming in and maybe wanting to make a bike with wider tyres. Are there any sweet spots within that range in terms of what's practical for actually building into a frame, or, like you said, about tyre availability that really works for that for different bikes?
From my own experience of making and riding bikes, but also what people tend to be converging towards is... as long as it's not a super small bike and therefore the 700 size wheel becomes difficult, then settling something around like a 38 or a 40 millimeter tire seems to be where most people are settling on, that giving them enough tire volume to do everything that they want to do, and it doesn't push things so far that you have to dramatically change the geometry away from something that will feel perfectly at home on tarmac. You know, it might be that they ride it as a road bike for 3 months and then they put bigger tires on it, and so something around that sort of tire volume seems to be a pretty good happy medium where you don't have to compromise things too much, but it gives you a bit more versatility.
People do often they want something that can accommodate larger, don't they? So I know from making my own frame, it seemed like, well, if it can be up to, I don't know, 50 mil wide tires, or or like, can it hold a 2.1, maybe a 2.3, and you know it's like monster cross size kind of proportions. But the thing is with that is, yeah, often people do want to ride them on the road as well, and you don't have to ride very far on road on 2.1s to know that you'd rather be riding on something narrower.
So if you had that sort of sweet spot, let's say 40, is there anything stopping you designing a frame, or any limitations to take 650B wheels as well with a wider tire?
No, typically at that volume, that's pretty straightforward. It's fairly easy to kind of switch between those two, especially if you're not looking to kind of add mudguards and stuff like that as well. That can change things a little bit, but yeah, at that sweet spot, it's pretty feasible to assume that you can swap between a much bigger 650B tire or a slightly smaller 700. Yeah.
So when it comes to the end of the process, when you look at things like paint, is that something that you need to have any different considerations for, whether you're looking at road or off-road purposes?
It's not a huge difference, is there? There are some finishes which are more durable. There's also some finishes that are way more expensive, and like for me, that's something I kind of probably learnt the hard way with my gravel bike. I got a fancy paint job and a lot of quite expensive components, And then I went to a gravel race and raked them all across a bunch of gravel and rocks and roots and carbon crank set with dings and chunks out of it. You know, it's that's one thing I think is worth considering is, maybe going for the really flash stuff on a bike that's designed to predominantly spend all of its, well, predominantly spend a lot of time around dirt and rocks, then, you know, maybe there's smarter things, choices you can make. Powder coating is a good example, isn't it? Really, really robust finish. But then there's even arguments for it not being such a suitable choice for bikes that are used in harsh conditions. It chips in a very particular way, which could cause potential problems. You often talk about this, Tom, don't you? Like paint is more flexible and...
Yeah, I mean... Paint's a difficult one, and it sort of depends on what paint and how it's applied and all the rest of it. But powder coating can be more durable in some ways, but often when it chips, if it chips right down through the whole layer of the paint, then it will tend to, corrosion will tend to spread underneath the paint much more quickly than if it's a wet spray paint job. I guess it depends how precious you are about the finish. I think that's the thing, is that inevitably this type of bike is going to see rougher use, and it's more likely to look scruffier quicker than a road bike, for example. So my main bit of advice to students is to try and not feel too fussy about that, because it's just inevitable that it's going to look a bit beaten up fairly quickly.
A huge thanks to Tom Sturdy and Jack Watney for having us at the Bicycle Academy. I'd really strongly advise you check out some of their work online. Just search for Sturdy Cycles and Luft Cycles and have a look at those. And we'll also be putting a load of pictures that we took on our trip to the Bicycle Academy on our Instagram account too, so check those out as well. Now, we're not riding in this episode, unfortunately, but we do have a route for you. It's one from last summer when we visited the Bicycle Academy for a dirt ride, which they put on in collaboration with Komoot. It's just under 70 kilometres or 44 miles, and it takes in the beautiful Longleat Estate, past the zoo, past Heaven's Gate sculpture, and then heads down towards Shearwater Lake through the forestry trails, which are absolutely cracking. And then down on the side of the lake, you'll find this amazing cafe, which, let's face it, is pretty much the focal point of any route. You can download this route along with any of the others that you've heard about on Unpaved through our Komoot account. You can find this via the link in the show notes. And if you're new to Komoot, you can download a free region mapping bundle just by going to komoot.com/G. That's KOMOOT.com/G, and entering the code UNPAVED in capitals. We'll put all of those instructions down in the show notes so you can find it later. We're going to talk to one of the Bicycle Academy's alumni, Adeline Moreau, who is founder of Mercury Cycles. I met up with Adeline in London in her office where she works as a designer when she's not making bikes, and we sat down to talk about how she got into frame building and then her approach to it. Could you start off by introducing yourself?
Of course. My name is Adeline. I am a designer and I'm also a bicycle frame builder. I started Mercury Bikes some years ago from the desire to make custom geometry bicycles available and appealing to a wider audience than they were doing at the time. It's Wednesday in French, and I'm from Belgium. On Wednesday afternoon, you don't go to school. You've got time off to do whatever the fuck you want, which is what I think we all like to do on bicycles, and that's kind of the spirit of the brand and what I try to foster in the bikes that I make. And it's been amazing to work with people who really, really get that and feel completely aligned with that ethos. So that's the very short summary of Mercury, I suppose.
So from what you've said, that sort of playfulness about Mercury, I think that really comes across if anybody's seen them online or in the flesh, not only in the amazing paint jobs that you design, but actually in the character of the frame.
Yeah, so from the beginning, I was very vocal about not wanting to file my fillets. It's something that I drew the line on. I was consciously making the decision to only do things in the fabrication process that would improve the ride quality and the likeliness of people riding their bikes. And for me, the filing of the fillet made the time that it takes to make a bicycle really go increasingly high, whereas the quality of the ride feeling would not change. And so as a statement, I decided not to retouch the fillets of the frames from the beginning.
And what does that mean exactly, filing the fillets?
So once you've done the fillet brazing, which is the way that you join the tubes together, you can rework the brass with files or sanding paper to smooth them out and make the transitions visually pleasing. In terms of mechanical properties, that has the advantage of not creating any stress risers. So if there is in the joint a high point or a low point, or like a dramatically high point or a dramatically low point, that creates a stress riser and increases the chances of the joint to fail. So having smooth fillets has this advantage. But if you make fillets that are smooth and that are really well controlled, then you don't increase that risk. And so the trade-off in terms of time can be, it can take as long to polish off the fillets as it takes to make the frame up to the point of filing. So
that's a huge investment of time, which obviously relates to the price.
Exactly. Yeah, to the price or to the capacity of the builder to earn a living. I think that frame builders have been known to not be able to really earn a decent living from the work that they do. And for me, one of the I love making bikes, but I still have to pay my rent. So I have to make decisions that make my business sustainable, and that was one of them.
Interesting. So let's go right back to the beginning. What actually drew you into frame building in the first place?
So, like I said, I'm a designer, and I live and breathe to solve problems. And I had a problem, which was that I was racing cyclocross and my bike was shit. at the time, it I was riding a 49, and bikes in that size were meant to be the bike that would fit everyone below a certain height. And that meant that all the angles were really compromising in terms of the handling, just so that the more people could fit the bike, if that makes sense. And so that meant my bike had a really slack head angle to avoid toe overlap, and had a super steep seat angle to make the reach as short as possible, so that you could increase the reach by changing the components basically on the bike. So all of that I learned later. At that point, the only thing I could say was that the bike was bad. It didn't ride well. And I couldn't
feel that.
Yeah. And so I tried a few different bikes and I didn't like them. And then I was thinking, well, I have to solve this problem for myself. And that's how I found out about the Bicycle Academy. And so I went on a 10-day course, I think, with the aim to make a cyclocross bike that would work for me. And then in that process, I learned a lot about bicycle geometry, especially cyclocross bike geometry, and especially what that meant once it's applied to my body in movement.
Yeah.
And how the industry has standards, and those standards have limitations, and how when you design a bicycle, you have to take all of this into account and pick the best compromise.
Yeah.
And that was amazing and a really great process, and it was so good to be under the guidance of all the team at Bicycle Academy, who really take the time to dive deeper in topics that are of interest to you, and really clue you up as much as they possibly can. And if they can't teach you everything in 10 days, which of course is impossible, they can, like, they really also teach you to learn. And that was really crucial for me, I think. I felt super empowered to carry on building the knowledge from what I picked up at Bicycle Academy and into my life as a frame builder in the future.
Amazing. So where did you go from there, from your very first frame?
So I made this frame and then I came back to London and went back to my normal work. I never set out in this journey to become a frame builder. It was not my goal when I went to Bicycle Academy. So I came back with the urge to make more frames and thinking that if I had run into that problem of bicycles feeling weird, other people would have had this issue too. So as it turned out, lots of my really close friends were experiencing the same, so we looked together into the possibility of making bikes for them, and I was super lucky that Bicycle Academy and Shand supported me by passing on a set of tubes that Shand had won at Bespoked the year prior. So I went back to Bicycle Academy with the aim of making 3 bikes in one go. I was trying to apply a different process and kind of grouping actions together and see if I could make a bigger number of frames in a shorter relative period of time. So I was at Bicycle Academy to do that. And after that experience, so I produced 3 cross bikes over the course of 10 days again, I think. And then it seemed like the theory was working. If I could group bikes in batches, and if I could carry on not filing my fillets, I could make bikes in a very respectable amount of time, and so make frames that weren't too expensive. So I tried to see if it was possible to design a process that would allow me to make bikes in a quicker way. And so if I could make 3 bikes in a batch and I could carry on not filing my fillets, then I could make frames in a more sustainable way. So that was the theory. And after spending that week at Bicycle Academy making this first batch, it seemed like it was going to be possible to do. And after that, I had to find a workshop because I couldn't. I love Somerset so much, and I would spend all of my time at Bicycle Academy if I could. But unfortunately, that wasn't really an option. They have to also teach other people. And so then I started trying to find a workshop where I could carry on practicing. And that's when I met Timmy Rowan, and I was lucky to move into his workshop in Kent. There were 3 of us there, Timmy, Tom, and myself, and we were working on Rowan's frames, and then I was working on my own at the same time. So I made another batch there, and it was really nice. It was a great place on earth to be making bikes, and Timmy and Tom are wonderful people, and I was really lucky to spend time with them. But it was really far away from my home, and there's only that many times you can camp on a worktop before it really stops being fun.
Yeah.
Or at least for me, I think maybe some people might find it differently. And then after that, I got to share the workshop with Tom Donohue and later Rob Quark, who moved in as well. And that was also really wonderful. For me, the possibility of working alongside other people, even if you don't work together, is super important because you can go crazy in a workshop by yourself. It can feel like everything is conspiring against you and the metal is colder and, you know, the days are always shorter and so on. So having been able to work with other people has been of incredible value.
Am I sure that you spend a lot of time sort of discussing different practices or way of doing things as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And even though everyone's brands are different and everyone's customers are different, it's like problem solving is much better done in a conversation with somebody else than by yourself, just in terms of efficiency as well. And that's something that I find is true in both frame building and my design practice. Sometimes you just need to talk things through, and that's really important to me.
So your very early frames were cyclocross builds,
yeah.
Sort of really orientated around mostly smaller riders, would you say? Or did you then start to go into other people. And how did that then move into other types of bikes?
I made a bunch of cross bikes to start. I think that's because cyclocross is really close to my heart, and I am Belgian after all. and the cyclocross bikes are very specific, and for small riders at the time, it was really a challenge to find a good cross bike that fitted them and did the job well. So I could add value there, and so people were interested in that.
Yeah.
And after that, I made a few road bikes because I had friends who wanted to support me and were into road riding, so they commissioned road bikes off of me, and I tried to really inject the same playful spirit into the road bikes. And I never actively tried to... or at least I don't think it was a conscious decision to mostly make off-road bikes, but naturally my work gravitated towards that, and people who were riding off-road were gravitating towards me. So as my work went on, I started making more and more cross bikes, and then Grinduro happened, and I got a chance to make a hardtail for myself and test out a few things I had been wondering about mountain bikes. And after Grinduro, I started making a lot more hardtails and feeling more comfortable making hardtails for riders that were looking for the same sort of riding I was looking for. I think that's also quite a big part of Mercury's identity, is that I love riding bikes, and I am surrounded by people who love riding bikes in really silly ways, and that makes people who feel the same way gravitate towards us. I think it's just, that's how it works with brands, isn't it?
So going back to what you said about Grinduro then, so were you approached through the Bicycle Academy to make a bike specifically for the event?
Yes, it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was so lucky.
And did you have a blank canvas? Could you make anything, or did they specify the kind of bike they wanted you to make?
So there are a few actors that came to play in this Grinduro mountain bike, and because I had been making lots of cross bikes, I was asked if I would make a cross bike for a Grinduro. And Tony, the bike fitter who I had been working with, knew that I was interested in making a mountain bike. And I think so I was initially asked if I would make a cross bike. And of course I said yes, and I was so excited. And then Tony mentioned, a meeting happened in which I wasn't, and someone brought up the fact that I was interested in making a mountain bike. And so the next thing I knew, I was making a mountain bike to race. How incredible. You want to make something, and the opportunity to make that thing and test that thing and race that thing happens all in one go. It was the most incredible experience of my life.
And it was the first hardtail that you've made.
And it was the first hardtail I ever owned.
Wow.
Yeah, so I went back to Bicycle Academy because these guys know about mountain bikes more than any of my friends or any of the people I could, or any of my network I could have tapped into. So I went to Bicycle Academy, and that's where I made the frame for Grinduro. Again, it was amazing, and I was so lucky. I got to try a few of the bikes that they had there to understand what specific geometries would mean in terms of ride feel, and discussed to really great length with Andrew, with Buff from BTR, with Shaggy. Like, all these guys have been riding mountain bikes for so long. And so I felt like the knowledge that I didn't have, they could really explain to me that if what I was looking for was this, then what I should be doing could be this, that, or the other. And I felt really empowered to make the right decisions to make this test bike, which I still ride today as much as I can, and I love it to bits.
Well, it obviously went down really well for you.
Yeah.
And Aaron.
Yeah, it was, that was a...
So what happened?
Well...
I'm getting embarrassed now.
As part of this adventure, I was also invited on Aaron to do a recce ride, which made me even more keen to make a hardtail. I thought a hardtail would be the perfect bike for that.
Because it's quite varied conditions?
It is really varied. Oh, it was very varied on Arran. You had some big fire road climbs and then some like single track descents and all sorts of things that are timed. So I think you have to know about me is that I am highly competitive.
Anyone who's ridden with Adeline will know this.
I will tell you otherwise. I will try to pretend that I'm not. But as soon as there is racing involved, I'll just do everything I can. And so I was like, all right, I have to make a bike for this show. The other people that are making bikes for this show are like people, frame builders that I've looked up that I would like, I wouldn't be able to speak without turning purple and, you know, spitting on them. Like, I really respect them, and I didn't know them personally at the time. So I was like, okay, I really have to up my game to like give a good impression when I'm there. And also I really have to beat them at the bike race.
That's all you cared about, really, isn't it?
No, I didn't do that. But I won my category by quite a long way, and that was amazing.
Was that the women's overall?
No, I was in the under 30s.
Yeah.
I didn't sign up in the elites, and I think I would if I did it again.
Yeah.
And then my bike won the public's choice, awesome. Which, as if the story wasn't great enough, meant that I could go to California to race the Grand Tour over there. So sent my bike and myself to California.
Which was the original Grand Tour, right?
Yeah, in the, I forgot.
Is it Quincy?
In Quincy, yes, exactly. So all of that was nuts and so wonderful.
Yeah. So you've had this amazing opportunity, thanks to Grindr and the Bicycle Academy, to make something you've never made before. And then you say that you've done quite a few hardtails since. Mm-hmm. Like, has that really facilitated you to broaden the sort of spectrum of bikes that you make?
Yeah, so I think a few different things happen. I think with good stories, it's always like there are some ingredients that are always the same. You get lucky, and the timing is right. Mm. And I think for me, luck manifested in this opportunity to make something for Grinduro. And then the times, I think bike riding is changing and more people are becoming interested in riding off-road, and those who had been riding cyclocross were interested in riding mountain bikes, and hardtails is kind of the front door to mountain biking, I think, for cross riders or for road riders. So it kind of coincided perfectly that people that were into cross or into road riding and that liked my brand were shifting towards wanting to ride mountain bikes.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I was making mountain bikes, so that just worked out perfectly.
Yeah. And in terms of your fleet, it must be a wonderful, wonderful skill to have to be able to make your own bikes, right? And make exactly what you want. So you've got your cyclocross bikes, which you race on, your hardtail, which you do all sorts of amazing adventures on, including sort of months epic around Morocco, which, looked amazing with like the rack set up on the front and everything. Yeah. Sort of in between, there's this gravel bike territory. Yeah. Have you been tempted there, or have you made gravel bikes?
My opinion of gravel bikes is maybe not the most popular.
Oh, go on.
I ride my cross bike or my mountain bike, and I have never found that there was enough of a need for something that was in between the two.
Okay.
But I'm really lucky that I have those two incredible bikes. Yeah. So for me, having a steel cross bike that can take larger tires kind of negates the need for anything else, because it's comfortable enough to ride for a very long day. It doesn't like it feels really I feel at one with the bike, whether it's for 50 minutes all out or whether it's for 8 hours of longer effort. And when I think about gravel riding, I think, and I try to draw the line between what is cyclocross and what is gravel. Yeah, I think the length of time is the biggest differentiator for me. Now, because my cross bikes are made of steel, which gives them a ride quality that just feels so good that I could ride this bike into eternity, I've never really felt the need to make a bike specifically for long days of semi off-road riding.
Yeah. And I guess, does the custom fit? So getting fitted before you make the bike,
exactly,
whether it's for yourself or for a customer,
exactly,
makes a big difference to that.
So every bike I make starts with a very in-depth bike fit that's done on a jig, so not on an existing bicycle, to remove any blockers or any barriers to finding the best position in space for your body to perform at its best. And so that gives you three contact points, which are where your hands touch the bike, where your ass touches the bike, and where your foot touches the bike. And then you have these three points in space, and then you design the frame to accommodate for those, and then to accommodate for components and standards from the industry. Like, I can't invent a new wheel size.
Yeah.
So the industry standards of things that you select, and then the ride feel that you're aiming to get to. And so you could decide to have different bottom bracket heights or different head angles or different seat angles and so on and so forth that would make the bike ride more one way or another. But as far as I'm concerned, between my two cross bikes, I cover all the ride qualities that I am hoping to get out of a bike that I would ride on gravel, if that makes sense.
That does. And you were saying about the custom fit. Is that different if you get a custom fit for, say, road racing, and then maybe you want to try gravel riding? Would that be a different fit, or can you just rely on the one that you've had for road?
Yeah, so if you think back at the contact points and you think about road racing, where you would usually be on quite smooth surface, you want to be locked into the position where you can be as powerful as you possibly can for the length of time that you want to go on during the race, right? Now, if you transfer this position onto rough terrain where your body gets shaken around, and you imagine that you like roll over a rock, it makes your body jump up, and all of a sudden you might lose the bottom of your pedal stroke, or you know, you might not be able to be as in control of the bicycle as you would be if the terrain was smooth. Do you see what I mean? So the constant adapting your body to the terrain that you're riding on is more dramatic in off-road riding than it is in road riding, because it's less bumpy, basically. So that's a really long way to answer your question, which is, in my opinion, to be in control of the bike better when you're riding over rougher terrain, you need to be in a position that is slightly different from your road racing position, where what you want to be is like locked in in a very specific position.
So different in what way?
So I don't want to say, like, generally speaking, it would mean you drop your saddle by this much or that much, because everyone is different.
Yeah.
And it could manifest in a variety of different ways. And like we said at the beginning, bike design is a compromise between all of the factors that come into it. And you might need to accommodate for larger tires, you might need to accommodate for different head angles so you don't get to overlap, or all of this stuff. And so you have to think about all these moving pieces. And because it's not about changing your fit on your road bike so that you can ride over bumpy terrain, we're talking about two different bikes, I think, in this specific context, it's hard to say you should just drop your saddle by a bit.
Because you don't know what the original one's like.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Does that answer
absolutely.
Your question?
And the other thing that you were saying about your own cyclocross bikes, was that you have loads of clearance on there for bigger tyres. Mm-hmm. And I know that you've done some really amazing sort of bikepacking tours like Slovenia on your cross bikes and stuff. I guess that's maybe where, if you're in complete control of the design yourself and sort of looking towards how maybe bikes are progressing, cyclocross bikes traditionally might have had very tight clearance or tighter clearance because the standard, the UCI dictates that you can only ride 33s, whereas a lot of gravel bikes now are 40s plus.
Yeah.
So was that a conscious decision when you were making those bikes to make them more versatile or future-proof?
Yes and no. So there are a few reasons why having large clearance on a cross bike can be a good thing. And one of them is I typically make bikes for privateer racers who just ride by themselves or, you know, race by themselves, don't have a pit crew to clean their bikes or whatever. And that having enough clearance for the mud to move away is can be crucial for these people to finish the race.
Well, it can be make or break, right?
Exactly. Whereas if you think about the way that cross bikes were traditionally made or are made the Belgian way for the Belgian pro racers, these people can change bikes. Like these people have three bikes sometimes that they switch from through a race and they get cleaned like in between each swap. So the clearance there becomes a bit less of an issue because you can like reset back to zero every time. So thinking about that, and thinking about the fact that I'm making bikes for people that turn up to the races with like less infrastructure around them, having big clearance is important. Okay. And then 33mm tires are great to fit the UCI regulations, but that's not what you might want to ride on all the time. And again, a lot of the bikes that I make become like the bike of the person who has it, and so being able to ride it in different conditions, so we would always design it to be the best it can be at one thing, but also try to accommodate for what the rider aspires to do outside of that very specific one thing. And so having big clearance is a good thing for that. And then the bike you were talking about, the cross bike Beth was riding in Slovenia, was designed to switch between 700C and 650B wheels, and so be UCI legal for bike racing, and then take big rubber for bikepacking.
And I think that's really interesting because we're almost getting into this like anti-N-1 phase, where I think for a long time a lot of people have been like, oh yeah, get another bike, get another bike, get another bike. And I think as we start to be more environmentally conscious and think about the processes that go into to making these things, or maybe just living in small spaces where you can't have loads and loads of bikes. A lot of people are interested in this sort of one bike to rule them all concept, whether you could have one bike and a couple of different wheel sets, for example, whether that's road, cyclocross, gravel. So that's really fascinating.
One thing to say about that is the best way to be environmentally conscious when you're thinking about bikes is riding the bikes you have. If you're replacing all your bikes by the one bike that does everything, it's not a good thing, because you're effectively getting one more bike, even if you move on with the ones that you already have. So I think we have to be conscious when we think about it, because it's also a move from consumerism industry that's trying to make us want something different and just take everything with a pinch of salt is what I'm saying.
So I was very lucky to have a bike made by you.
And I was very lucky to make a bike for you, Catherine.
Fabulous purple number that you've probably seen online or something. So that's an interesting story, like really on this subject, because I was really into cyclocross a couple of years ago, and I'd looked on with sort of green-eyed envy at your bikes and a lot of our mutual friends' bikes, whilst riding a bike that fitted me pretty badly, that I was very, very glad to borrow off of a friend, but and I finally bit the bullet and sort of ordered my Mercury through you and had the bike fit, and it was, you know, going to be the best cross racing bike. But actually, I knew I wanted it to be able to take on some of the rougher, gravelly stuff at the same time. And I've sort of since fallen out of love with cyclocross a little bit, which is sad. I still love watching it, and like watching you race is incredible, and watching it on TV. But I guess racing isn't really for me. I'm not as competitive as you are. And I think that's like, I raced it once for cross, but it's been my gravel bike ever since. And I think because it was built with my exact proportions in mind, and I guess for me what I wanted out of a cyclocross bike was quite similar to a gravel bike. Mm-hmm. It's like been perfect, and I've never been uncomfortable or anything. The one thing that I have found is I put the same saddle on it as I had on my road bike build, and that's not as comfortable as it is on the road bike. And that actually Tony, who does your fits and fitted me, said, oh, I'd advise a different saddle, because I think it's a much more upright position.
Yeah, so if we think back about being locked in a position on the road bike, where you might be maybe bent over more, your pelvis is tilted more, and so the pressure points on your saddle are different.
Exactly.
Than if you're a bit more upright and your pelvis is tilted back, and so the soft tissue that is like pressed on the saddle is pressed in a different way, or just a different part. So yeah, you can find that a saddle works for you really well for a road bike and then doesn't work at all for you for a mountain bike, and the other way around.
So when you're thinking about designing bikes for off-road purposes, what sort of considerations, or especially drop bar bikes, should we say, to start with, what kind of considerations do you need to take into account in terms of the frame geometry and how that looks?
So the rider's position, how to put the rider in space so that they are comfortable and powerful and use their muscles in the best way, number one priority. Once you've got that, you want to talk about what the rider wants to do on the bike. Well, one of the things that I like to ask the riders that I work with is, if you like picture yourself riding that bike, what are you doing? It might not be something that you're able to do right now. Just like imagine what the future
the dream
could be.
Thing on
yeah.
that bike.
Aboard that bicycle. You know, and ask
winning
them
world
to
champs.
Exactly.
One
but
good
world
dream.
Champs of what?
Box snorkeling or something probably.
But so that's really helpful, because I think for me, it's really important to speak with riders in human terms, you know, terms that they understand. And I don't expect people to come to me and tell me I want this seat angle and I want this head angle. Instead, I hope that they say, I want to feel confident when I'm descending steep stuff, or I want to be able to ride for a very long time. Currently, I'm not so great at climbing, or, you know, so these kinds of things is what informs how I design the geometry of the bike. And I try to then play it back to the rider, saying, this is one way to design the bike, and it will feel probably this way. And other option, we could do it that way, and that means it will feel different in those ways. Sorry, this is quite a vague way of explaining.
No, it does make sense. So I guess it's more of a two-way process, and making sure that you're both aligned.
Exactly. I think that's really important. And you also have to remember that when we're making a custom bike, we're effectively making a prototype every time. We're discussing of all the things that we're hoping to achieve, and the feeling that we're hoping the bike will have, but we don't get a chance. Most of the time, we don't get a chance to make the bike and then improve on the bike. So it's really important to really dialogue and make sure that you understand each other, the frame builder and the rider, so that you can work together towards achieving the dream of the rider.
Absolutely. But I guess there have been a couple of instances in your frame building career where you have made similar types of bikes for the same riders, like for the cyclocross races on your team.
Yeah.
Do you find that that's a process of sort of communication with those guys and girls to like constantly improve on what you're making?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a few things to unpick there, I think. I have three bikes that I made that are different, and in which I tried to experiment with certain aspects of the bike design, both from aspect of geometry, materials, and like kind of bike. That means my two cross bikes are not identical at all. They have different rakes to the forks, they have different head angles, they have different bottom bracket drop, and they're made of different kinds of steel. Now, if you really wanted to test something precisely, you would only do incremental changes. So you would make two of the exact same bike, but in two different selections of steel, for example. Then you would be able to say precisely how these two steels feel different.
Wouldn't that be a privilege?
It would be very labor intensive, but it would be quite fun. And the same goes for every aspect. If you wanted to really pinpoint what a different difference in bottom bracket drop feels like, you would need to make that the only thing that is changed between the two bikes. So I can't do that, unfortunately. I can't have these many bicycles that are different. So I tried to test out a formula that I think will influence the riding quality in one way. I tried to picture how different it will feel and then make the frame and then test out how different it does feel. And so that's how I do it for my bikes. And I like to test stuff on my bikes first because, you know, it's better than to test something on a customer's bike and then turns out it doesn't work.
So you are your own guinea pig.
Exactly. So I'm the first level of guinea pig, and then I'm so stoked to have a cross team, which is made of four riders who were not selected based on the fact that they have similar body proportions, but they do have similar body proportions. So it's really interesting to see how people that are seemingly similar in their bodies, when you just look at them standing still, how different these bodies move once they're put in a bicycle racing environment. And then I made bikes for them that where we tested a few different things again. Like, we tested different forks, we tested different geometries, we tested different clearances and so on all those team bikes, and that influences how I make cross bikes now. So that's been incredible and so lucky, and something that I think when I think about making bikes and designing bikes, and when I think about design in general, testing and testing with people is one of the most important parts of my process. And obviously, I only get to do it at a very small scale because I'm a one-person company. Making bikes by hand, and I'm not a big bicycle manufacturer, but I think getting to test my theories on real riders is a crucial part of making good bikes.
Absolutely. And also, your team has the world's coolest kit.
I'm glad you think so.
Do you really enjoy sort of bringing those design elements of your experience into it?
Absolutely.
I guess the paint jobs as well.
Yeah. So one thing to mention about paint jobs on off-road bikes is that another kind of research aspect of this work was to work with Rob from Colorburn Studio on developing a paint scheme that would work for off-road bikes in terms of durability, and would also take everything that is loud and leery about Mercredi and apply it to bikes that will be trashed on the race circuit. And so we worked on that quite closely, and it's been a privilege to work with Rob because he really he's really open to experimenting, and he's open to pushing the brief as far as possible. And I believe we did that when we worked on the team bikes by designing a paint that is a paint scheme that is really durable but really stands out massively, but also was the process of applying the paint to the bikes was designed and decided between Rob and I in a way that would make his work as efficient as possible.
Yeah, so it's coming back to your core principles as a brand.
Exactly.
Again.
Because I love bright colors and beautiful designs, and but again, do they influence the right quality? Do they make the rider more likely to jump on their bike and ride? I think yes, to an extent.
Yeah.
But the paint isn't everything, and with for those bikes anyways, and so whereas they're a component of the system, they need to be, you know, they need to be held to the same standard as everything else, which is usability and function.
Yeah. I found that a really fascinating part of the process when we were working together to come up with the paint job for my bike, mm-hmm. Because we had this sort of mood board thing going on in a Google Drive, and I was sort of fleeting in all different directions over what I wanted. And I guess you could want like some amazing tropical camo or something, but like realistically that's going to cost a lot of money. So it's working out something, again, it's a compromise between something that looks great and makes you fall in love with your bike and want to ride it, but it's also functional and also isn't gonna, you know, cost you the air.
Exactly. It's you every decision you make, I guess that applies to life in general, but you have to take lots of different things into account. And in the case of making a bike from scratch, and if you look just at the paint element of that, it's a balance between your budget, your taste, the brand of the frame builder you're working with as well, your timeline, and you know the durability and what you want to do with the frame. And again, I think it's the job of the frame builder to accompany the rider in like all this decision-making process. And it can be really daunting, I think. It is called paralysis of choice when yes. you start from a blank canvas and you're told you can do basically whatever you want. It's so hard to make a decision. So in terms of paint, I like to ask people to share with me things that they enjoy the look of, and it doesn't have to be bikes. In fact, it's better if it isn't bikes. And, you know, collect that for a while, and then we try to extract the essence of it and turn it into a paint design. I don't expect people to turn to me and say, I want a bike that is red and the RAL code is this, and the logo will be this size, and then this. No, we have to go in this process together.
Yeah, I think I spent maybe 3 months sending you Instagram accounts for all my favorite illustrators, yeah. and you sent back ones of like rugs.
I love rugs.
So I guess, well, one last question on that. Have you ever made a black bike for someone?
No. Yeah, actually,
it's against Mercury.
It's not against the rule. If you give me a good reason to make a black bike, maybe we'll make one. But
I'm sure Morgan Frost would like one of those.
No, Morgan. We've discussed many different bikes with him. So, there is one notable story of a rider, Chris, who wanted a black road bike, and he ended up having a sparkly purple and gold leaf road bike, and I love that bike, and I believe Chris loves that bike too.
Yeah. You talked him round to the purple sparkles.
I didn't actually I didn't try to convince him to do the purple. It was a journey that we went on together, and I believe it was when I was visiting Cole and Dan showed me this purple paint that he had, and I was like, oh my fucking god, this is amazing. And then I like took a video of it to really show the sparkle and send it to Chris, who was like, oh my god, yes. And yeah, the rest is history. But so people do ask for black bikes. probably less so now that they've seen, like, you know, if you go on my website, you probably don't think, oh yeah, I love black and gray, this person, this stuff. There is a really cool, another cool road bike that was like a three-step fade that was kind of rubbed from one stage to the next to look kind of worn out, and it's quite cool. And then the peace sign on the front, the hand is like a skeleton, and I guess that's the closest to a black bike that I yeah.
Nice. So I guess my last question for you, Adeline, is off-road bike design has changed a huge amount in the last 10 years or so, but where do you see the future of off-road bike design going?
I think everything is a cycle.
Yeah.
I guess we'll all ride clunkers in the next 3 years.
Amazing. What's a clunker?
Well, you know, I think we're going back to the roots of mountain biking, and we'll just ride rigid bikes. with 26-inch wheels or something.
Flat bar, 650B.
I don't know. I don't have the answer to that.
Where would you like to see it going?
I think we'll see more and more people coming from road going into mountain biking and hardtails. I think then this will like go back full circle, and then we'll all start riding track bikes again. joking aside, I think everything that I do today in terms of bike design could not exist if it wasn't for people who invented the mountain bikes to start with. And I think a lot of the gravel kind of scene is taking cues knowingly or unknowingly from the early 1990s mountain biking, in terms like both in terms of how people choose to dress up as well as how they choose to ride, and so I think that's just simply is how it is with us humans. We just do things in cycles, and I think people will carry on finding ways to enjoy riding their bikes when they, you know, when they've done something a bit too long and they need to refresh, they'll find another way to ride, which will have probably been the way that lots of people have been riding before, if that makes sense. I didn't explain myself very well, but
okay, so I'm gonna end with a bike packing question, and this was a very saucy one when we rode out with Steph from Pania, who you know very well, and a bit of an opinion divider. When you're bike packing, are you dangle or anti-dangle?
I think the real question...
Here we go.
I think the real question is...
Here we go. This is going to be good.
Okay. Dangle or don't dangle, but always bring your poo shovel. I feel really comfortable talking about the poo shovel, and that's because I was made to feel comfortable about it in the way that the first person to introduce me to a poo shovel did it. And so I feel like it is my mission
to spread to make people
feel okay about talking about poo shovels, because it's like, it's fine. If you're going on a bikepacking trip and you try to not have a shit because you feel uncomfortable talking about it, you're going to have a horrible time.
Okay, so, but would you dangle your poop shovel? Is that a thing?
I mean, if it makes people feel more comfortable talking about the poop shovel, I will.
I think I'm going to have to make you like a really colourful, wonderful, with like a little poo hole in it,
hat.
So that you can dangle it with a vole strap or something.
My poop shovel is bright orange, which
it's unmissable.
Which matches my spork, and I've never mixed them. And I really hope that this never happens.
Brilliant. Thank you, Adeline.
Thanks for having me.
So that brings our episode with the Bicycle Academy to an end. So thank you so much to Adeline, Jack and Tom for having us, and everybody else at the Bicycle Academy who put up with us raiding their biscuit tin and drinking their coffee. If you want to ride the route from this episode, head on over to our Komoot account, search for Unpaved Podcast, and do share it with us when you go and ride them, or any of the routes that you go and ride. We're really keen to see. All you have to do is tag us on Komoot, or you can tag us on social at Unpaved Podcast. We're stoked that even some of our listeners have made gifts for us, which you can find on Instagram if you just search for Unpaved, and they're amazing, especially the dangle mug one. So thanks, Phil and Erwin. And then we're really, really grateful to Komoot for supporting us and for making this possible. We're essentially after the same thing, which is to help people get outside and adventure more and explore more. So we're really, really stoked to be working with them. And we're already working on series two, which is really, really exciting. So let us know who you'd like us to visit or where you'd like us to visit. We've already got quite a long list, but I'm sure you've got some great ideas too. And we'll have a pretty tough job trying to narrow those down. So until then, happy riding, go safe, go where you can, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye.